Matter of State versus John Bragg. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Evan Banderas, Deputy Public Defender on behalf of John Bragg.
Assistant Prosecutor Colin Rizzo on behalf of the state.
Is there anyone here from the ACDL?
Good morning, Chief. Lee Bartan on behalf of the ACDL. Avi Muller, who will be walking in momentarily, will be arguing.
Ah, okay. Momentarily, as in perhaps right now. Very well. Let's hold off for a second, Mr. Ventura. Please be seated.
Thank you.
Mr. Muller, you're welcome to join us at council table now. Are you arguing for the ACDL this morning?
Yes.
Please come forward. And the attorney who was scheduled to argue had misfortune in his family, and I appreciate your stepping in.
Easy, Chief. Thank you.
Ready to go?
Yep.
Mr. Ventura, please.
May it please the court, may I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if necessary?
Yes.
We can all agree that there was a violent confrontation in apartment 9H between Bragg, Anderson, and Fletcher. All three suffered serious injuries that required immediate medical care. The point of contention is whether Bragg acted in self-defense. On that score, the jury heard two very different versions of events. Bragg testified that he was bashed over the head with the toilet tank lid by Anderson and attacked by Fletcher when they tried to steal his drug stash. He testified that he defended himself with a pocket knife to save his life. In contrast, Anderson and Fletcher testified that Bragg flew off the handle unprovoked, that he began stabbing them over some perceived insult. Deciding what actually happened is a quintessential jury function. For the jury to fulfill that function, they must have accurate and complete instructions on the law, and that includes accurate and complete instructions on the law of self-defense. Here, the jury was instructed on self-defense, and it was instructed on the duty to retreat. In other words, the jury was told that Bragg could not invoke self-defense if he could safely flee from the conflict. The jury was erroneously not instructed on the exception to the duty to retreat, that Bragg had no duty to retreat from his own dwelling. This instructional error requires reversal of the convictions in a case where self-defense was the central issue and where the state's efforts to defeat self-defense focused on Bragg's opportunity, or his purported opportunity, to safely flee the apartment during the conflict. This concludes my opening statement. The definition of dwelling is found in 2C.311C. Dwelling means any building or structure, though movable or temporary, or portion thereof, which for the time being is the actor's home or place of lodging.
Could you keep your voice up, please?
Yes. Thank you. It's clear that the legislature intended a very broad definition of dwelling. It could be a portion of a movable temporary structure that is the actor's place of lodging for the time being. Very, very broad, all-encompassing definition. In this case, there was significant evidence that apartment 9H was Mr. Bragg's dwelling. He had been staying there for a few weeks before the incident. He had an informal sublease agreement with the tenant. He had an electronic fob to enter the building and a key to enter the apartment itself. He had a bed, cookware, a TV, and personal belongings, including clothing and allegedly his drug stash, also allegedly alcohol that he provided to Anderson and Fletcher. And he testified that he was in the process of moving the rest of his belongings from his niece's home. He told Anderson and Fletcher that was his apartment. Facts suggesting that he didn't live there aren't particularly compelling. The appellate division noted that he needed to use the sign-in sheet to enter the building. Well, that's to be expected if he had an informal lease. If he swapped 6 months or maybe 4 months of rent for a used vehicle. This isn't something that went through the management office. It wouldn't have been an approved lease. It was Anderson who testified that he had seen the sublessor's mail in the apartment. That doesn't mean very much. I've lived in my home for 10 years and I still get mail from the woman from whom I bought the home. The court noted that my client had a Georgia driver's license and registration. To that, I'd say, well, he does need to switch that over at some point, but nobody contested that he had lived in Georgia at some point in the recent future, or recent past, rather, but that has nothing to do with the definition of dwelling.
During the initial charge conference, the trial court explicitly stated quote, in retreat, I'm going to need some guidance from you folks on the applicability of dwellings. And then counsel for your client explicitly stated that she, quote, can't imagine that the dwelling exception to the duty to retreat needed to be charged. And the self-defense charge should be given without adding the dwelling exception to the duty to retreat.
Yeah, Your Honor. So it's a little more complex than that. Defense counsel, if this court is considering the invited error doctrine, we're suggesting that this is plain error because it wasn't raised below, but not invited error because she did not induce or encourage the trial error. At the preliminary charge conference, defense counsel did appear to agree with the court's inclination that the duty to retreat exception doesn't need to be applied. But everybody agreed at that time that the issue could not be decided then. At that point in time, there were five more witnesses, including my client, who had to testify.
But it wasn't even the court's inclination at the beginning. The court really just said, I'm going to need some guidance from you folks on the applicability of dwellings and things like that. I haven't heard right now. I'm going to need guidance. And then defense counsel said, I can't imagine that needs to, and then was cut off. And right now, the evidence before the court, it appears as if it's not his dwelling. But it was before that even that defense counsel said, I can't imagine that needs to. And then it became clear what she meant was, I can't imagine that needs to be charged.
Yeah, and Your Honor, the crucial point that I'm trying to make is that occurred at 17T at a preliminary jury charge conference before the parties had rested. If I could direct your attention to 17T, page 103, the court says, all right, so we'll just have to wait and see how things unfold on that. Defense counsel, right, the court, because we can't go any further now. And I appreciate the hypothetical nature of some of this.
There was no point later where the defense counsel said, Judge, I see the evidence going in a different direction from where I think he needs the dwelling charge.
True, Your Honor. That defense counsel definitely should have at that point in time. It should have been obvious to everybody after, especially after the cross-examination of my client, and especially after the state summation that's focused on his ability to safely retreat. Should have been obvious to everybody. Defense counsel should have objected to the charge. And that's why we're arguing that this does meet the plain error standard.
Because the second charge, sorry, so after this preliminary conference where defense counsel says, you know, she couldn't imagine why the dwelling exception would have to go in, then there's the final conference and it's circulated without the dwelling exception. And at that point, defense counsel says, yes, I agree, or yep, I agree.
And the point I'd like to make in response to that, Your Honor, is that there wasn't a true meeting of the minds. The court said it thought that the dwelling language had been taken out of the written charge that they were discussing. Defense counsel said she thought she was looking at an earlier version of the charge, and then they moved on to discuss other matters. I would like to direct the court to 19T, page 27. The court says, I think that what we circulated took out the dwelling in the porch language. Defense counsel, okay, I just might be looking at an older, the court, yeah, you might be working off an older one, I know that. Prosecutor, any concerns regarding the adequacy of the charge? Prosecutor, no, judge. Judge, okay, let's move on to parts one and two.
Is it defendant's position? I'm sorry, please go ahead.
So there seems like there was some confusion. Absolutely. During that back and forth during the final charge, whether the defense attorney was looking at a prior version of the jury charge that included the dwelling language.
Maybe.
Is that what, that we're not sure?
We're not
what
sure,
that contained, is that correct? I don't think we see that from the record.
That's correct, right, it's not clear.
But so, it seems like there was something in some prior draft of the jury instruction that included the dwelling exception.
I assume they're referring to 17T, the previous pretrial conference. I don't have anything else in the record where this was discussed. I think that's what they were—
Has counsel who represented defendant at trial ever contended that the second discussion of this was affected by her having the wrong version of the charge? Because I haven't seen that.
Did defense counsel below ever basically squarely raise an objection to the charge?
No, I'm asking a different question. What did defense counsel ever say, I now realize I was looking at the wrong version of the charge? Or are you basing this argument on the meaning, interpreting the meaning of that, frankly, yeah, very cryptic comment?
That's right, Your Honor. It is cryptic. And I'm interpreting that in a way that gives the benefit of the doubt to defense counsel.
But even if that is true, and the defense counsel was looking at a different version of the charge that didn't have the dwelling exception, and then the court said, all right, so we can basically say that parts one and two are good. And defense counsel did not say, no, Your Honor, because the dwelling exception needs to be added. Or no, Your Honor, because I'm looking at an old version and in my version, the dwelling exception is included and that needs to remain. The defense counsel didn't say anything. So it had been the initial charge conference. Defense counsel says, I can't imagine why the dwelling exception should be charged. And then at no point is there anything ever changed about that from defense counsel.
True. So again, I can't emphasize enough that defense counsel should have said, Judge, let's take a look at the definition of dwelling. It's really pretty broad. I think earlier we misunderstood that this, you know, because, well, first of all, we were talking about this in a vacuum before we had the testimony, but let's look at the definition. You know, this is leaping off the page in the words of DeNova.
This is beyond simply a failure to object, which we see obviously in many cases where the just for whatever reason, it doesn't occur to one lawyer or the other not to raise an objection. There's a judge raising the issue, the lawyer, at least at that preliminary stage, saying, I don't see any reason to charge it. And then there's obviously the testimony, and there is the only communication is by defense counsel saying, essentially, don't charge it.
Yeah, Your Honor. And so I would say that this is something is invited error or it's not. There's no, you know, super plain errors, you know, super, you know, it's a discrete category. And I would say that this does not fall in the category of plain error because, excuse me, of invited error, because in the words of Jenkins, defendant didn't in some way lead the court into the error. I recognize that some of the invited error jurisprudence is much broader. It talks about
some of the invited error jurisprudence is a very close situation. Obviously, the distinction here is that in that second conference, there might have been another opportunity. But when lawyers say to judges, don't do it. No, we don't want that charge. And there may be strategic reasons they have that the court is not privy to. That generally falls within invited error, doesn't it?
And in this case, I can't conceive of any strategic reason for leaving out.
I understand.
Yeah. So I would just say, Your Honor, that I don't believe that this reaches the level of invited error. But even if this were invited error, in the words of State v. Corsaro, the error cut mortally into the substantive rights of the defendant. The entire case depended on self-defense.
Counsel, before you go on, can I ask you a question? I think there's another reading of the colloquy.
Which one, Your Honor?
From the charge conference, from the preliminary charge, the one on March 11th. So Ms. Lyons, they're talking about the charge, and Ms. Lyons, the judge is saying, I need help on this. And Ms. Lyons says, you mean just the one, a dwelling, right? The only place in that charge that starts with a dwelling is the last sentence. And that says a dwelling includes a porch or other similar structure. Later on in the colloquy, Ms. Lyons continues. And she says, right, but I'm saying, here, it's charged where applicable, and dwelling includes something indiscernible of a similar structure. I don't think that can come in. Is it possible that what Ms. Lyons was talking about was not the charge in total, but the last sentence, which says a dwelling includes a porch or other similar structure?
That's a very reasonable interpretation, Your Honor. Yeah. I mean, my initial position is there was not a meeting of the mind, so it doesn't rise to the level of invited error. It was not the court being petitioned to a certain result. It was more like a bumbling acquiescence. But that earlier colloquy could be read to be talking about the second language. And if you look at the second paragraph of the only language in the entire charge that's currently written that's relevant, charge where applicable, this is in the justification self-defense charge. An exception to the rule of retreat, however, is that a person need not retreat from his or her own dwelling, including the porch, unless he/she was the initial aggressor, period, and then a footnote. And in the second sentence, a dwelling includes porch or other similar structure. So there's very little discussion, even in the best case scenario, that would have been given from the model charge. It's quite possible she was referring just to the porch language because there's no porch that we know of in Kingsbury Apartments.
Except they do keep talking about the as applicable stuff. And as you pointed out, the as applicable comes from the dwelling exception as a whole, not just the part about the porch. So when there is back and forth where the court says without the charge with applicable stuff, Ms. Lyons, right, yes, okay, all right, Ms. Lyons, it's just the same. It would just be how it is by retreating. So it seems like they're talking about whether or not you charge the as applicable part, which is the whole dwelling exception, or whether you don't charge the
possibly
as applicable part.
Possibly, Your Honor. As you said, it's a bit cryptic.
But I want to go on to the rest of that, because I think it's important. The judge then corrects her and says, no, that sentence is not what I'm talking about. Because the judge says the fact that the structure that they were in would constitute a dwelling of somebody's is, I don't think that's the issue. So the judge is saying the structure, the only structure only occurs in the last sentence. That's not the issue. So the judge thinks she is talking about that last sentence, right?
That could very well be. That's a very fair interpretation. That's giving her even more benefit of the doubt than I had initially. Yeah. But what does that do? That highlights that we, looking at this now, are still scratching our heads. So how could this have been a meeting of minds? How could have this been an active petitioning of the court to take this approach if we're looking at it on a court record and we're reading it over and over and over and can reasonably disagree about what it means?
Counsel, let's say for argument's sake that in the original jury charge, the conference before the defense case starts, the judge includes the jury instructions directly out of the manual, and it has the language included. They're talking about it. And then we move forward to the jury charge conference after the defense case, where it's excluded. And the defense attorney says, yep, I agree. What do we do with that in terms of analyzing it in light of invited error? How do we look at that?
Well, again, Your Honor, if you go to 19T, what defense counsel says is she doesn't say, I agree with, she says, yep, I agree. And then she says, oh, I might be looking at an older. So she might have been agreeing to the charge that included.
She says, yep, I agree after that, no?
No, she says, yep, I agree. Then the court says, I think that what we circulated took out the dwelling and the porch language. Then she says, okay, I might be looking at an older, presumably.
And based on the interpretation that we just discussed with Justice Hoffman, the court specifically refers to taking out the porch language as opposed to maybe a larger portion of that dwelling exception. And if the defense attorney is not looking at the actual draft that the judge was looking at, there could have been some confusion with regard to what was taken out and what was left in. Again, yeah. The defense attorney should have ensured that she knew exactly what the charge was going to be, but it kind of lends itself to some confusion as to what was before both parties and what the understanding was to what I agreed to, because again, the court in that final charge conference mentioned the porch language, which.
Yeah. And Your Honor, I'm not taking this out of the error realm, but defense counsel shouldn't have done more. I'm saying this is not invited error, and all of foregoing seems to support that. That's a very fair interpretation that that counsel actually was on the ball, but if she wasn't pushing the court in that direction. So this should not invoke invited error doctrine. And if it does, even if it does, this is the kind of error that goes to the very core of a fair trial. This is what this case was about. It was self-defense. And how did the state try to defeat the self-defense? Very, very forcefully focusing on my client's alleged ability to safely retreat. Which
you say that this case was all about self-defense, but there were many charges, correct? And self-defense was charged to the jury as a defense to some of the charges, but not to many of the charges. So kidnapping, terroristic threats, child endangerment. As far as I can tell, the jury was not charged that self-defense was a defense to any of those, because it's not. So if you read the kidnapping statute, there is no defense of self-defense. And if you read terroristic threats, there is no defense of self-defense. So how can it be, even if there was a fatal error with the self-defense charge, wouldn't the remaining convictions for kidnapping and terroristic threats and child endangerment remain because there cannot possibly be a self-defense defense to those charges?
I understand your Honor's argument. I would ask the court to look at this a little more pragmatically. Practically speaking, the viability of self-defense colored the entire trial. For example, it is very unlikely that the jury would have found that Bragg used unlawful force to defend himself, but then was criminally liable for exposing the young child to violence, right? It's very unlikely that the jury would have found him criminally liable for confining Anderson and Fletcher if he had just used the proper level of force to protect his life with a pocket knife. So true, it doesn't fit very neatly. You know, there's nothing about self-defense that obviously negates an element of kidnapping or endangering the welfare of a child or terroristic threats or harassment. But this was a package deal. Pragmatically speaking, they're going to believe the self-defense and probably exonerate him for most things, although maybe not harassment that occurred a couple weeks earlier, but most things, or they're going to pretty much reject everything.
So you're saying even though self-defense could not be a defense to kidnapping, the jury could have still seen it as such?
It would have. It certainly would have. If it had believed that my client had just gotten bashed, he walked into his apartment, got bashed over the head with a toilet take lid and says, oh boy, I'm in trouble here. They're trying to hit me with pots and pans and steal my drugs and probably kill me. These are drug addicted people who are high on some of the drugs at this time. I'm going to use my pocket knife, wield them away. I think for the most part, a jury is going to look at that and say, yeah, he did what he had to do. There's not necessarily...
Mr. Manjuri, the state is making an argument that look at all these other convictions for these other offenses. They give us the clue, they give us the answer to what should happen to the principal charge that this debate about self-defense relates to. And your position, of course, is no. Don't try to read into the murder charge all information from these other offenses. Aren't you doing the opposite now?
No, Your Honor, because I'm talking about assessment of probabilities. In the latter scenario, there's an admittedly terrible jury charge at the very core of the trial. So we're looking, practically speaking, where does that spill over? In the scenario about trying to reconcile inconsistent verdicts, this court has a long and very clear history of case law from 1986 on. State v. Crisantos, I think, captures it. It is speculative to forecast what a jury would have returned if properly instructed on the basis of a verdict that a jury returned after an incomplete instruction.
But you're doing some of that in reverse right now.
I understand there's a little bit of tension there, but I'm saying it's because it's for very different reasons. We're not trying to get into the jury's mind to try to reconcile arguably inconsistent verdicts. We're looking at how the error might have spilled over. I see it's similar, but the jurisprudence is not similar. I'd refer the court to State v. Federico, in which—
Isn't it generally done when, if there is, and you are arguing that there's a defect in the jury instruction with respect to one offense, don't other offenses generally survive if they do not have that aspect to it that was considered by the court to be problematic?
Generally, yes, as a general rule, Your Honor. But there are certain times, and Federico is one of them, 103 NJ 169, where the error is so significant that it spills over into everything else. Even if this court were inclined to try to reconcile the inconsistent verdicts here, the kidnapping conviction doesn't mean that the jury rejected defendant's testimony or believed that he was the initial aggressor.
Why does it have to be an inconsistent verdict?
I don't think it is inconsistent.
Oh, I thought you just said even if the court was inclined to try to reconcile the inconsistent verdict here.
It would then find that they are not, in fact, inconsistent. It would be a more terse.
Isn't the inquiry, if there is a defect in this charge, that meets whatever standard applies to it, isn't the inquiry as to which charges did this affect?
Yes.
And the answer is the murder charge.
The answer is obviously it affects attempted murder, aggravated assault, unlawful possession of a weapon, and possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose.
Because those all have the self-defense as a potential defense.
And I'm saying—
but the rest of them, why?
Why would the kidnapping charge fall?
Well, again, Your Honor, I understand it doesn't speak directly to it, but I'm urging the court to take a more practical understanding of what it would be like to be that juror. If you had decided that my client had just used a pocket knife to save his own life, how are you going to find him guilty of kidnapping? It's possible you might find that afterwards he exceeded the authority that was granted to him by self-defense and kept them too long or used too much force. It's possible. You could see that in the abstract, but it requires a bit of the speculation that I would urge the court not to go down here or when trying to reconcile inconsistent verdicts.
But doesn't it require speculation in the other direction?
Well, that was Justice Rabner's question, and I see the point. But what I'm saying is that it's a different calculus applies. When you have what I think is a clear jury error at the very core of a trial, we're trying to determine how can we make sure that Mr. Bragg gets a fair trial on everything. Does it obviously spill over because there's shared elements? No. Does it practically spill over because that's how this case was presented from the very beginning to the very end? Yes. And that's a different scenario than what Chris Santos or Mohammed speaks about.
So what factors should we look to see if that practical spillover exists?
Well, I think it's how the case was litigated. If you go to the opening statement, the defense at the very beginning was, yeah, this was a terrible incident, but my client was just defending himself in his home when they tried to steal his drugs. You look at the state summation. The state says, this is a person who claims that for an hour and 45 minutes, an hour and a half, he was fighting for his life, that he couldn't get out of the apartment. He was being attacked by Fletcher and Anderson, and he did what he had to do. The defendant was the one with the weapon most of the time. Again, why would he not just run out of the apartment? So the whole time, and also through the cross-examination, the focus was that he had gained the upper hand and could have gotten out. Therefore, self-defense is front and center in this case, but it's defeated because we're arguing that he could have gotten away safely without resorting to deadly force because he wasn't in his own dwelling.
But even if that was incorrect, how does that impact kidnapping? Just because it was the overall flavor of the case?
Yes.
So there's nothing particular in the kidnapping statute that you can point to that would be impacted by self-defense.
And that's true. And I would also say that temporally, it's possibility that my client used self-defense to defend himself against the charges to which self-defense obviously applies, and then committed a kidnapping. He may have said, well, now I've got the upper hand and I'm going to make you pay. Now, that's a lot of speculation. I'm just saying temporally that could exist. But practically speaking, this error at the very core of the trial affected everything. That's really my position.
Don't you need for that to exist to fend off your adversary's argument to the opposite, that in reality, because the defendant was found guilty, that they must have found that the defendant was the aggressor? Like, don't you need that speculative temporal component to exist to separate those two out so that your adversary's argument is not actually bolstered?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor, if we were to go contrary to Chris Santos, Mohammed, and a million other cases that tell us not to speculate, don't look behind the curtain because it requires an inquiry that courts aren't willing to make into jury deliberations. But yes, if we were to do that, that temporal explanation is one way in which it's not facially inconsistent for the jury to have found my client guilty of the aggravated assault and the kidnapping, but not because he was the initial aggressor, but because he had a duty to, they believed he had a duty to flee, which he didn't. And then later they believe he exceeded that authority provided by self-defense.
And I've got to admit, with what Justice Wiener after and what the Chief Justice was saying, it feels a little bit like you want your cake and you want to be able to eat it too on this one, in which you're saying you can sort of speculate in one area, but you can't speculate in another.
That's true. I would like to have my cake and eat it too. And the reason, again, it's because we're talking about two different calculations. One of the calculations is where we can all agree that this case was about self-defense. He clearly should have gotten the benefit of the non-duty to retreat. And how did that affect everything else? Yeah, there's some speculation there, but we're going to err on the side of preserving his right to a fair trial. On the flip side, we can't find answers to these without being too intrusive, without calling the juries back and asking them questions. So I guess in a way it's a cake and eat it too kind of scenario because the two interests are not balanced. And to the extent that something has to give, it's to the defendant's benefit. If this court truly does see these as completely irreconcilable positions, my client's right to a fair trial and confidence that he's gotten that fair trial should mandate that result.
Other questions, anyone?
Could you just tell us, is that true, even if we find that there was an invited error? Your client's right to a fair trial trumps?
The result or the fix, Your Honor, isn't dependent on what standard this court uses to find that there was, in fact, an error at the core of the file, whether it's clearly capable of producing an unjust result or cutting more mortally into the client's substantive rights, the fix would still be the same.
I don't know that I understood your...
Okay, Your Honor. So reversal, I mean, we have two different standards of reversal, right? Because we want to incentivize defendants from making their objection known in a timely fashion and avoiding gamesmanship.
Incentivize them to make their objection known.
And avoid gamesmanship, right? Taking one position and then say, no, I don't want that after they've lost. So we make it a little bit harder, or maybe significantly harder, for them to prevail on appeal if they haven't made their position known below. But either way, whether you're reversing because you agree with me that it's clearly capable of producing an unjust result, i.e. plain error, or cutting mortally into the client's substantive rights, i.e. invited error, the fix is the same. You get to the end point, which is reversal, and what needs to be reversed. I would suggest to this court everything, because that's the way this case was litigated from the very beginning to the very end. And it was not realistic to think that the jury was going to find self-defense to apply here and not there. It was a package deal, so to speak.
But you don't have any case law that would support you on that.
Well, Federico, Your Honor, doesn't go into a lot of analysis, but it seems to endorse the result that I'm looking for, 103 NJ 169, that it rejects the argument that, specifically rejects the argument without a lot of discussion, that there wasn't a spillover effect.
But when you said, sorry, that it was a package deal and that self-defense kind of applies to all or none, that's not how the judge charged the jury. And that's not how the verdict sheet, like self-defense was just never listed as a defense to any of these other charges. And there's a life sentence on one of the kidnapping convictions and concurrent on the other two, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And there was no objection before the judge, you know, actually, judge, I think self-defense should be a defense to kidnapping as well. This whole case is about self-defense. We need a self-defense charge re-kidnapping, correct?
Correct.
Counsel, tell us which charges the self-defense charge applies to here. Obviously, murder.
Attempted murder, aggravated assault, unlawful possession of a weapon, and possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose. That's what the court instructed, and I don't take issue with that.
So you agree that it doesn't apply to kidnapping or child endangerment or terroristic threats?
Not directly, Your Honor. So there's no element that is directly negated.
And the jury wasn't charged, for example, that they could possibly apply it to any of those three charges, correct? And those charges remained. The jury had to decide, is this defendant guilty of kidnapping, yes or no, correct?
Yes.
And they could not say, yes, but it was justified by self-defense. That was not presented as an option to them.
Right.
And same with child endangerment and same with terroristic threats.
True.
And that was correct, right?
I believe that's
because
correct.
Because self-defense is not a justification to those charges.
I believe that's correct. But I believe that the way that this case was litigated, it was a de facto justification. That a jury...
Meaning what? You know, obviously, the self-defense is... It doesn't come out of the ether. It's a legal justification that applies only to certain offenses.
So we believe this all happened at one time, right? So they would have found probably factually that a kidnapping hadn't occurred. Not that self-defense directly negates an element, but they would say, okay, well, maybe one of the elements of kidnapping didn't occur here because that's how I can reconcile in my mind that Mr. Bragg did use self-defense, and he's not guilty of anything. He used just the amount of force that he needed to protect himself.
Would you agree you could not have asked the trial judge to charge self-defense as to the three charges Justice Wiener Apter just went over, kidnapping, child endangerment, terroristic threats?
Yes.
Aren't you, in effect, asking us to apply it now, though?
Yes. In effect, again, Your Honor, because we have... admittedly, an error that goes to the very core of the trial. And this was the way that the case was litigated. It's just not practical to think that the jury was going to accept, that was going to reject self-defense. Well, I mean, I don't know how many other ways to put it. It's simply unlikely for the jury to convict at that point
We understand
your position. I'm losing my train of thought here, but that's the point. I mean, he's not going to be held criminally liable for confining Anderson or Fletcher. Practically speaking, if the jury believes that my client just used the amount of force that he needed to defend his own life against two attackers in his own home. So I guess I would say while it doesn't negate an element directly, it would probably significantly color their factual findings.
That it could have impacted the jury's decision on a whole.
Certainly
we don't know that, and we shouldn't speculate. But the question is whether this alleged defect in the jury instructions had an impact on the jury's decision as a whole, because in reality, the jury was likely looking at the entire event altogether.
That's correct.
As opposed to
practically segmented. Speaking, that's how this case was litigated from the very beginning, and that's when we have a charge at the very core of the trial that's so fundamentally flawed. If there's any doubt, we should err on the side of preserving my client's rights to due process and a fair trial.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. We'll have you back for rebuttal. Mr. Mullen.
Good morning, Your Honors. First, I want to deeply apologize for my tardiness. I want to pick up from where the court left with Mr. Ventura before moving on to my statement, if the court will allow me to do that. The way we see the kidnapping issue, Your Honors, is it's a twofold confluence of issues. First being the principal side and looking at Federico and seeing that when there's a similar factual narrative across the charges, as there was in Federico with kidnapping and other charges unrelated to the kidnapping and the issue of whether or not the jury was charged with unharmed release in the instruction, that taints the rest of the charges. Looking at this case in particular, I think what Mr. Venger was, my understanding of what Mr. Venger was arguing is when you look at the temporal difference between when the jury could possibly have determined that Mr. Bragg committed a kidnapping, it is inextricably intertwined with self-defense, because one of the elements of kidnapping is confinement with purpose to inflict injury. Now, when that purpose to inflict injury occurred, I think is greatly impacted by self-defense, because if the jury had determined that the purpose to inflict injury occurred when he was the initial aggressor, let's say, that would be a time where self-defense de facto would negate the charge of kidnapping, as opposed to if the jury focused more on a purpose to inflict injury later on, self-defense would not necessarily impact that.
Sorry, I didn't understand that. I thought that if the person is the initial aggressor, then there's no self-defense anyway. So why would self-defense negate if they thought he was the initial aggressor?
If the theory is that he's the initial aggressor, excuse me, Your Honor.
Oh, you don't mean if the jury found that?
No, I mean if the jury was looking at the side of the story of the victim where he is the initial aggressor, and that is the infliction of injury, the purpose to inflict injury that they incorporated into their determination that he is guilty for kidnapping, then charging them with proper self-defense and then them finding that that was not a purpose to inflict injury connected to confinement for kidnapping purposes. It was a reasonable use of force in self-defense.
But the jury was never told they had to make a determination about who was the aggressor with respect to the kidnapping charge, was it?
Say again, Your Honor.
Did the jury need to make a finding about who the aggressor was with respect to the kidnapping charge?
Well, with respect to the kidnapping charge, the jury has to make a determination whether or not the confinement was with the purpose to inflict injury.
Indeed. Can you answer my question?
Your question is as to the initial aggressor.
Does the jury need to determine anything about who the aggressor was to convict on kidnapping?
No. It's whether or not the defendant had the purpose to inflict injury tied to the confinement.
So aren't we speculating that they would have incorporated questions about who began the fight in order to reach their determination about kidnapping?
I like to use the word hypothesizing in this instance, Your Honor.
If they did that, they weren't following the court's instructions, correct?
In terms of?
If they incorporated essentially the concepts from the murder charge into the kidnapping charge that doesn't have the same elements, they would not have been following the court's instructions.
Well, with regard to the court's instructions, I'm referring to what instance of infliction of injury the jury considered. We don't know. Standing here, I have no idea what the jury talked about behind closed doors, which instance of inflicting of injury or purpose of inflicting of injury the jury determined, coupled with the confinement, led to the conviction of kidnapping. And that's the point. Because if that instance of injury infliction was the same injury infliction that would have been determined to support self-defense, then it could very well be that the jury would say, well, that in that instance of infliction of injury or purpose to inflict injury could not possibly be with a purpose of confinement because the purpose was for self-defense.
And if the jury injected self-defense into its consideration of a kidnapping charge, it would have diverged from the court's instructions, would it not?
It's not so much, Your Honor, the consideration of self-defense as it applies to kidnapping, which it does not. It's rather what the jury gleans from the defendant's actions based on a complete instruction. Thank you, Your Honors. We have less time now, so I'll try to make this brief. In addition to supporting all of Mr. Vinger's arguments as to plain error and reaffirming that it is the province of the jury to make credibility and factual determinations when there is evidence before it that the location of events was defendant's dwelling, the ACDL wants to emphasize the importance of an explicit holding from this court that the plain language of NJSA 2C311 necessitates a broad interpretation of the term dwelling that is not limited to primary or permanent residence. Mr. Venger defined the term dwelling. I think it's very clear from our briefing, from the dictionary definitions to the commentary on the Model Penal Code to cases outside of this jurisdiction that have applied the same or similar definition of the term dwelling, that it is not limited to a home or a domicile or a residency.
Wouldn't that be dicta? Because in this case, the defendant is arguing that it was his primary dwelling. So I think your argument had been that this court needs to determine that even a temporary house guest, it is the temporary house guest's dwelling.
Yes.
But to me, that seems like it's going beyond what is required to decide this case, because the defendant is not arguing that he was a temporary house guest and instead arguing that this was his residence and he was just in the process of moving into it.
Yes, but the state's characterization is that at best he was a guest. So it is part and parcel of the issues, because while defendant is raising the issue that it was his home or that he lived there, the opposite side is that at best he was a guest. And what we're asking the court is, you need not even evaluate the evidence to determine which characterization is correct, because all you need to do is apply the statute as written, because the broad interpretation of the term dwelling applies to both characterizations, regardless.
Do you think there's a difference between the phrase his dwelling and the phrase his own dwelling?
I do not, Your Honor. I think I know what you're referring to, and the state made a point of emphasizing his dwelling or his own dwelling, but if you read the remainder of the state's arguments, the focus is really on the definition of what a dwelling is, and the focus being on, as the state noted and as the appellate division noted, an out-of-state driver's license, whether or not Mr. Bragg's name was on lease, whether he was making payments, the fact that he exchanged his car for 4 to 6 months of stay. Those might be an indicia of residency, and that might qualify as a home. But that's one word in the entire definition of dwelling.
So when the trial court used the phrase his own dwelling, and the statute uses the phrase his dwelling, you don't see there being any distinction between those two?
It's a fine distinction. I can see how his own dwelling versus his dwelling. But again, a dwelling could be, as seen in some of the other cases, a hotel room. It could be a weekend fishing shelter. It could be the home of a friend's acquaintance when the acquaintance gave them permission to stay for a night. So it's from a possessive standpoint, it's his dwelling or his own dwelling, but the dwelling is the same in that it can be a home that you bought and that you pay mortgage and taxes on, and it could be a place that you're staying at a friend's house for honestly, even dinner, but certainly overnight.
How do we reconcile that with our language in State versus Gartland, where in this court held that the idea of a dwelling is that one has an exclusive right to occupy a portion of a building? That did not, and then I think there was an unlocked bedroom within a larger home that was not a separate dwelling from the rest of the home in that case. So how would that allow a dinner guest when he is at someone else's home for dinner to say that that is his dwelling while he's at dinner?
So that determination is more has to do, and this is almost every single case in New Jersey, which is why we've resorted to looking at cases outside this jurisdiction. It more has to do with which physical portions of a structure or a building qualify as a dwelling for these purposes. So if
but that's because the court focused on the exclusive right to occupy. So the court did not say an invited guest at dinner, you know, the home becomes the invited guest's dwelling during dinner, because it's not the guest's exclusive right to occupy if the homeowner is there with them eating, having dinner, right? That's the language I'm focusing on, the exclusive right to occupy.
So it seems that the focus is on exclusive, because if it's just the right to occupy, if you're invited into someone's home, you have the right to occupy whatever rooms the person invites you into.
Correct. I'm focusing on the word exclusive.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be an issue that butts up against the statutory definition of the term dwelling. And I think that's probably even more of a reason that the court should take this up.
But the dinner guest hypothetical really is beyond the facts of this case.
It's beyond the facts of this case.
So that really would be going far beyond what we would need to make any determinations in this case. So
absolutely, Your Honor. I only raise it as a point of example for reference. It was connected to the Hornberger case, which we cited from Pennsylvania. That's the only reason. We do not need to go so far. In this case, there's more than enough evidence that this was Mr. Bragg's dwelling.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Rizzo.
May it please the court. John Bragg was found guilty of attempted murder, not because the jury wasn't read a portion of the model jury instruction, but because they simply did not believe his testimony to be credible. If the defendant's conviction is overturned, it will enable future defendants to take one posture at the time of trial, only to ambush the state for the first time on appeal by taking an entirely contradictory position. Defense counsel in this case not only acquiesced, but in fact induced the trial court's decision to omit footnote 4 of the model jury instruction on self-defense. This case fits squarely into the definition of invited error. Invited error occurs where trial courts were induced, encouraged, acquiesced in, or consented to by defense counsel. And those are not ordinarily the basis to be overturned on appeal. Going one step beyond that, this doctrine applies where the court actually relied on the defendant's position in reaching a result that is State versus Jenkins. That's exactly what occurred in this case. Looking at the transcript from the preliminary charging conference, the trial judge said verbatim, "I'm going to need some guidance from you folks on the applicability of dwellings and things like that." That after that, defense counsel said that she can't imagine that language needs to be read. That is precisely the type of reliance that the invited error doctrine relies on. Here, the court stated that he was seeking guidance from the counsel. He literally asked defense counsel if this was needed, and because defense counsel stated that it was not, he did not read that instruction. Counsel also was given multiple opportunities to request this instruction at the preliminary charge conference and at the final charge conference after her client testified. Even going towards counsel's argument regarding whether or not there was a meeting of the minds, she could have objected or asked for a sidebar after the instruction was actually read. That did not occur either. Counsel was consistent in their view that the dwelling exception did not need to be read, acquiesced in and consented to the charge, and in fact induced the court's reliance on that charge. Going further, this case is analyzed under plain error because defense counsel did not object to and in fact participated in the jury instruction here. It's clear that the jury did not accept the defendant's testimony as being credible. The trial court made note of this during sentencing, where he stated, quote, the jury rejected this, referring to the defendant's testimony, and appeared to have rejected it emphatically. The trial court, after sitting in and observing a three-week-long trial, stated that it was his observation that Mr. Bragg's testimony was, quote, self-serving, not credible, and simply not true. Furthermore, the jury convicted the defendant on charges where self-defense was not applicable, as this court noted, kidnapping, terroristic threats, endangering, and criminal restraint all are not applicable to self-defense. Going further, and this is beyond the realm of speculating onto what the jury decided, the actual language of the jury verdict sheet noted that they found that the defendant confined the victims for a substantial period with the purpose to inflict bodily injury on or to terrorize them. It would be totally irreconcilable for the jury to make these findings that the defendant was guilty of kidnapping the victims, had the intention of injuring or terrorizing them, while also believing that the defendant was acting in self-defense. His testimony also definitively shows that they did not believe the defendant's testimony and did not find him to be credible. Because the defendant, in his testimony and in his version of the events, denied the fact that he ever tied up these victims. It was his testimony and his version of these events that this was all part of a ruse in which the victims tied themselves up in order to catch them off guard. The jury definitively rejected that in finding that he was guilty of kidnapping them. That demonstrates that they did not believe his testimony. Additionally, with respect to the issue of whether or not the trial court should have sua sponte requested this jury instruction, given the fact that it was not requested by defense counsel, I would note that this court has somewhat recently evaluated situations in which a trial judge must sua sponte instruct the jury on lesser included offenses. That was in State versus Canfield from 2023. In Canfield, this court held that if defense counsel requests an instruction, and this is as to lesser included offenses, they must be instructed as where there is a rational basis on the record. However, if they are not that charge is not requested, the judge only must sua sponte instruct the jurors where it was clearly indicated by the facts in the record. Under the clearly indicated standard, there's no obligation for the trial judge to meticulously sift through the entire record to determine whether or not a charge is applicable. Rather, only where the evidence is jumping off the page must the court instruct sua sponte. This standard was specifically created to be a more appropriate tool for appellate review and helps protect the possibility of reversing otherwise valid jury verdicts, which is exactly the danger that is presented here.
So, counsel, you began your argument focusing on invited error, and you give emphasis to that in your brief as well. Does that mean you're conceding there was error?
I'm not conceding that there was error, Your Honor. And as to arguments regarding the dwelling, it is still the state's position that this did not qualify as the defendant's dwelling.
So let's talk about that, because whether there was a duty to retreat turns on whose dwelling it was and who the aggressor was. And right. There's disputed testimony. Both sides present information with respect to whether this was indeed the defendant's dwelling within the meaning of the statute. Was the jury asked to decide that question of disputed fact?
The jury was not asked to decide that fact, Your Honor.
Is it appropriate for the judge to make that determination? And did the judge do so as a matter of law?
Well, I would say it's appropriate for the judge not to have sua sponte read that instruction.
Who should have determined whether this was a dwelling?
Well, defendants. Defense counsel, having obviously the most familiarity with the defendant.
Judge or jury? Who makes the call for purposes of determining whether there was a duty to retreat? Judge or jury?
Factually, whether or not there was a duty to retreat, that it would be something for the jury to decide.
Right. And that would mean that it was for the jury to determine factually whether this was defendant's dwelling.
I understand that argument, Your Honor.
And that didn't happen here.
No. And the reason being is because it was induced by defense counsel.
So you're back to invited error.
But I understand, Your Honor.
Even though you're saying there was no error, I want to talk about whether there was error, and then we can come back to invited error later, unless you're conceding there was error, and it doesn't sound like you are.
I'm not, Your Honor. So we can go into the arguments regarding dwelling.
My question was, who should have made that decision? Not for us. It's not for counsel or this court to decide. Wasn't that a question for the jury, that factual dispute?
So I apologize. Are you asking who should have made the decision whether the instruction should have been read or whether or not this actually was his dwelling?
So there was much made at this trial about whether the defendant had a duty to retreat.
Yes.
Agreed?
Correct.
And that would turn on whether this was his dwelling or not, and whether he was the aggressor or the other side were the aggressors, correct?
I agree.
There's evidence on both sides of both questions. Who was to make the decision, the judge or the jury, as to which evidence to credit?
Well, looking into the credibility, that is what the function of the jury.
Are you by citing the colloquy between counsel and the judge, are you saying that, presuming that counsel has a fair amount of information about their client, when a judge says, is this his dwelling? And I'm paraphrasing here on the transcript in front of me, but is this his dwelling? And you have defense counsel saying, we don't think this is a dwelling issue, that is a factor a court can consider in whether or not to submit the issue to the jury?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Defense counsel.
So when you're raising this colloquy, it's not just on the standard of review. It's as a factor in whether or not the judge was correct in taking it away or not giving the jury the charge about dwelling.
Precisely. I agree 100%.
But do you agree that if that colloquy happened before the defense case was presented, that the judge had an obligation to then review what happened during the course of the defense case when that information would have come to light, right? Because nobody else in that trial could have spoken to whether or not this was defendant's dwelling during the state's case necessarily. They could have talked around it, but they wouldn't have been the ones to say yes or no. Only the defendant could have testified to that, right?
So ordinarily, I would agree a judge would have that responsibility to hear that testimony and to give that instruction. That is why I'm referencing the clearly indicated standard, state's position that based on the contradictory factors as to the applicability here.
Why would the clearly indicated standard apply? Because that case was specifically about a lesser included offense. And here we're not talking about lesser included offenses. We're talking about a portion of the self-defense charge. And I thought your argument was the reason that portion of the self-defense charge was not included is because the judge asked defense counsel, should this dwelling exception be included? And defense counsel said no, or said, I can't imagine why that would be included.
So there is some precedent in using the clearly indicated standard in the context of self-defense. State versus Perry, 124 NJ 128 from 1991. The court did use that standard. Court noted that, quote, we cannot say plain error occurred when the court failed to charge the jury on, there's two issues here. So when the court failed to charge the jury on passion, provocation, manslaughter, and self-defense, the court found that the facts of that case did not clearly indicate the appropriateness of those charges.
But that dealt with passion provocation, which would have been a lesser included offense. And of course, that jump off the page standard versus, it's obviously a long established standard that applies when there's a dispute about whether a lesser included offense should have been charged.
So it applied not only to the passion provocation lesser included, but also to the issue of self-defense. The court went on to say that the defendant's testimony bore no indication of passion provocation and, quote, only offered weak potential support for self-defense.
It just seems that it's a weird fit in this case, because in many of those cases, the jumping off the page standard applies when there's oftentimes no discussion of a particular lesser included offense. Or here, of course, we're talking about a jury instruction, but the judge began the discussion about the dwelling instruction prior to the defense case. So it was relevant enough that the judge brought it up for discussion and even specifically said, we can't, that they have to wait until, that he would have to wait until we know what the defense says, but just highlighting it for something to think about. And I think what Justice Noriega was getting at was, after the defense case was put on, that discussion was somewhat revisited, but not quite to the level that it probably should have, given that the judge highlighted this issue beforehand. So this issue was out in the open for all the parties. There was a discussion. This was something that was clearly prevalent in the record before the court at the time.
And the judge
did. Would you agree with that?
I would say that it's something that was, I wouldn't necessarily describe it as jumping off the page, but I acknowledge that it was something
it was discussed.
I'm not disputing that it was discussed. It certainly was contemplated by the court.
And it was more than discussed in the context of, I want some guidance from the parties. Doesn't the judge give preliminary indication of where he's leaning?
I would argue no, Your Honor, because
here's what he says. And right now, the evidence before the court, it appears, is that it's not his dwelling. The judge wasn't sitting back as a passive actor during this conversation, it appears.
Well, at that, Your Honor, at that point, there was no evidence that it was his dwelling. That was from the preliminary charge conference before the defendant testified, which up to that point, it seemed everybody, nobody disputed the fact that he didn't live there. It was only after he testified. The trial court then comes back to that after defendant testifies during a final charge conference and ask again defense counsel whether or not any changes need to be made, and they say that no, there does not.
Is it fair to read the judge's comment and the judge's preliminary review of the evidence as the very invitation that Justice Noriega and Justice Pierre-Louis said called for a follow-up discussion?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand.
Wasn't it necessary to follow up on this point later?
I believe he did follow up later when
focusing on dwelling.
I believe the court did follow up with defense counsel during the charge conference, and defense counsel again said that it was not something that needed to be read. They said it was fine as was.
What do you make of that portion of the final charge conference where the judge says, and I think we circulated took out the dwelling in the porch language? What does that refer to? What is the state's position with regard to what that refers to? Because this case isn't dealing with a porch, correct?
Yeah, Your Honor.
So that's what the judge mentions was taken out of apparently the original draft or the first draft of the jury instructions. And he indicates on page 27 of that transcript, I think what we circulated took out the dwelling in the porch language.
And it's certainly a little ambiguous because we don't necessarily have context for what that is, but there's no porch that's applicable here. So
what was taken out was the dwelling exception as a whole, because that wasn't charged, right? So we know that it wasn't that the dwelling exception was charged, but just not the piece about the porch. The dwelling exception was not charged. So what was charged was what was on the page at the final conference, then it couldn't be anything about the dwelling exception because it was not charged, correct?
That's reasonable, Your Honor. That makes sense.
Was there a discussion anywhere about this aspect of the definition of dwelling, which is for the time being the actor's home or place of lodging?
So the only thing that I can recall that was discussed regarding that is, I believe the trial judge said something to the effect of, the issue isn't whether or not it's a dwelling, but whether or not it's his dwelling for the purposes of self-defense.
Just to be clear, when you say the judge brought it up the second time, this is at the end of the case, after the parties have rested, and it's now time to charge the jury, right?
Correct.
And what the judge said was, and the, I think that we circulated, took out the dwelling in the porch language. That's on page 27 of, I believe, 19T. So that is when the judge brings it back up in the context of the jury charge conference, correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, this is also at the point in which there had been a very long discussion before this conference, where it appears defense counsel was having a very tough time with Mr. Bragg, where he was uncooperative and unwilling to come into court. And that went on for several pages of transcript before we get to this part where the judge says, okay, let's jump into the jury charge conference before we finish up. Accurate?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So the only discussion was, I think that the otherwise the language regarding deadly force, non-deadly force, retreat, I think that's all appropriate in its general sense. Ms. Lyons then says, yep, I agree. And then there's the comment I just said. The judge says, I think that we circulated, took out the dwelling in the porch language. Ms. Lyons says, okay, I might just be looking at the older one. Court says, yeah, you might be working off the older one. I know that. And then prosecutor says, the judge says, any concerns regarding adequacy of self-defense charge? Ms. Sparkman says, no, judge. And then they move on to a whole other section. So that's it. That's the only discussion we have, knowing that there was this very controversial discussion regarding Mr. Bragg and his unwillingness to come into the courtroom. And what got into a very heated discussion between he and his attorney and the judge all during the course of this, right before this conference. And that's the only conversation we have about dwelling and this eliminated self-defense exception.
That's the only thing I could point to in the transcript. Although, again, the defense counsel, after the instructions were read to the jury, made no objection, made no attempt at sidebar to correct this issue. It appeared that throughout, from start to finish, they were in agreement with the way that the jury was instructed.
Counselor, and I'm guessing that it. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Is it? I would guess. Not an irregular occurrence for a judge to use shorthand to refer to something that has already been handed out in writing. So the fact that the judge is not reading into the record, and I think that what we circulated took out the, and then reading the entire part that was taken out to just reference what was taken out because they had already discussed whether or not it should be in, and then in this version it was taken out. I assume that that's not uncommon for that to happen.
Certainly not.
If we could roll back the clock and have the jury charge conference right now, and I'm trying to determine your position on whether there was error here, given that there's conflicting testimony on who the aggressor was and conflicting testimony on whether this was the defendant's dwelling, should the jury have been given guidance on those points?
Your Honor, it may have been a more complete and a more prudent instruction, but I would argue no, because it based on this definition of dwelling, I'm still not sure that it applies.
So the state would have argued at that point, no, judge, this definitely doesn't apply. Notwithstanding the fact that he had a key, that there was testimony about an informal lease agreement, that some of his belongings there, the state would have argued, no way, this is not his dwelling, do not charge. Is that your position today?
I'm going to the language of the his or her own dwelling. The defendant was following the procedures of a guest based on, and the only testimony we have comes from him. Obviously, I'm not discounting his credibility here, but he was following the procedures of a guest as even into getting into the building. He wrote his own name.
But what about the language of the statute, the language of the definition of dwelling that states any building or structure, though movable or temporary, or a portion thereof, which is for the time being the actor's home or place of lodging.
Yeah, and I understand.
Doesn't that plain language of that definition indicate that a dwelling could be a place where someone is just staying for a short period of time, even if he is a guest. And he, so, based on the evidence before the court, before the jury, he had a key to get into the apartment.
I would say it's two separate analyses. So yes, I'm certainly temporary occupancy, like a hotel room, or even it talks about impermanent structures.
Say or an apartment that you have a key to, where you're saying for an evening or more.
So an apartment certainly would be a dwelling. State's argument would be this is not his apartment. This is not his dwelling.
Does it have to be, does he have to own the apartment? Does he have to be the lessor of the apartment for it to fit within this definition?
So he does not have to be the ownership, but the owner of the apartment. But the fact that he is following these procedures, and they had the director of security from Kingsbury Towers or Kingsbury Corporation come and testify as to how tenants get into the building and how guests get into the building. The defendant signed his own name under the slot of a guest. So I would argue this is not his dwelling, and the fact that he is following the procedures and acknowledging that he is a guest here does show that he's, this wouldn't meet the definition of his dwelling.
So if he's a guest staying at this apartment for 2 months, has a key, 2 months, even less, that still would not fit this definition of dwelling from the state's position.
I would argue no, Your Honor.
You could have argued all those things to the jury, but instead you're suggesting it was good enough. If they could roll the clock back, it's good enough for the judge to make the call and remove that disputed question of fact from the jury, right?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Why not? Why not a guest? I mean, let's say I've got a beach house, very hypothetical. And I say to a friend of mine, you can stay in my beach house for 2 weeks. I'm not going to be there. Are you saying that that person who's staying in my beach house for 2 weeks, that would not be considered his dwelling, when we know dwelling has been defined as basically a temporary place where, I think it's Black's Law Dictionary, says where you put your head down on the pillow at night? How can a guest who has been invited to stay or allowed to stay, or in this instance has apparently made a deal with the lessor to stay, how can a guest not have access to this exception?
Well, because the words his or her in that statute, I think, do speak to this. As far as a broader policy reason, we are talking about using force that takes a person's life. We're talking about that.
We're talking about dwellings, what we're talking about. And how can that be reading the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, which is the standard right now? So you've got a situation where the defendant is saying, this is where I put my head down at night. This is where my stuff is. This is where I'm allowed to stay. How is reading that evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, finding that that's not his dwelling, when a dwelling can be a temporary habitation where you sleep at night?
Well, Your Honor, I would go back to the fact that his own defense counsel didn't think that it was his dwelling. I think that is.
His own defense counsel may have made a mistake. That doesn't answer the question for us, right?
Yeah, that's a fair point, Your Honor.
And defense counsel did make several points during summation regarding that he opened the door with the key, that he tried to use the key fob that wasn't working, that he had his clothes stack in a pile because he didn't have a dresser yet that he had intended to purchase, that there was a vehicle that was involved in a transaction for the right to stay for several months. Wasn't there enough there? Because the state, in its summation, relied on the absence of the exception, specifically stating the defendant was the one with the weapon most of the time. Again, why would he have not just run out of the apartment? So wasn't this a central dispute to the incident in general, if the state's making that broad allegation that he should have run out of the apartment, meaning a duty to retreat?
Yeah, retreat certainly, I won't deny that retreat was something that was highlighted quite a bit in the state's case.
And yet the jury didn't have guidance with respect to that.
Yes.
Adequate guidance.
And that's that retreat is something that resonates with the common person. Why not just run away? But if you're in your own home, your place of lodging, the place you lay your head down at night with all your possessions and effects, the jury wasn't provided any guidance to advise them. You are not, you don't have to retreat if it is your place of dwelling.
And that's
in a case where the state, like, as you just said, highlighted the defendant's ability to have just run off and left.
And that's where I think it comes back to plain error, because it's clear from the state's point of view that the jury wouldn't have accepted that even had it been read. They simply did not believe that the defendant was acting in self-defense. So even if this court does find ultimately that it should have been instructed, the state's position is that it's not plain error based on the fact that the jury clearly didn't believe the defendant.
So you're saying all of the offenses, kidnapping, terroristic threats, regardless of when they may have happened, all of them make a statement about who the aggressor was, and we should assume or imply or transfer that statement to the standard that would apply for the Castle Doctrine.
Well, it certainly makes a statement regarding their thoughts on his on whether or not the defendant was truthful.
On every issue. We should say, because they found him guilty, we can assume that his testimony on any issue would have been untruthful.
It's also just
pretty broad.
I understand that.
Why would you need to go that far instead of just saying the kidnapping and the other charges that we talked about before, to which self-defense is not a defense, would stand independently of whether there was any kind of error, plain or invited or otherwise, as to the other charges to which self-defense could possibly be a defense?
I think there's no question that those charges should stand independently. The only potential issue here is regarding self-defense, which has, as far as the state is concerned, no impact on the charges to which self-defense is inapplicable. So
what about counsel's argument that the jury, even if they weren't charged, that self-defense could be a defense to kidnapping? That was just the flavor of the case, and that was the whole case was about self-defense, so they would have found defendant innocent of kidnapping had they agreed that he acted in self-defense, which they could have only found had they been properly charged.
Well, I would argue there's, number one, no basis in the law for that finding, and number two, this is a jury that it appears did do a fairly good job of parsing through. There's other things that the defendant found, that the jury found not guilty in this case, one of which being unlawful possession of a weapon for the knife. There's certainly a reasonable basis that the defendant had the knife on him before this interaction even began, and it was a lawful possession of the pocket knife. This was not a case where the jury was simply doing a down ballot guilty or not guilty. They took the time to analyze every single charge here and come to their own conclusions based on the applicable law to each specific charge.
Other questions, anything you'd like to add, counsel?
No, thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Ventura, a brief rebuttal?
I have nothing further to add.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.